Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
All right, welcome to the Interpreter Show. I am Neil Rapley. I'm joined here in studio by my lovely wife, Jasmine Rapley. We should be joined by Spencer Marsh momentarily, though he is not here right this second. And I believe we do have our loyal and faithful friend, Hale Swift, on the line. Are you there, Hales?
Are you sure I'm there? Are you sure I'm not just an entheogenically induced figment of your imagination?
I do not know if... I have no way to prove that. I don't even know if this studio, this whole studio, is not just a... ethnogenically produced figment of my imagination, I guess. Or if all of life is just some big simulation. But
maybe you're a brain of that, Neil.
Maybe I am. But we're going to proceed on the premise that neither am I nor you nor anyone else in our audience is under those circumstances. But we have had we've got a lot that we could talk about and cover for this week. And in fact, do we maybe want to hit some news up really quick before we go into some of the more substantive discussions, maybe?
Sure. So this week in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there was a few interesting things that had happened. First of all, this last week there was, from my knowledge, the first ever youth music festival set to be a spiritual recharge for youth worldwide amid COVID-19. And it was a pretty star-studded event. They got David Archuleta to perform and some Latter-day Saint artists such as McKenna Hickson and one of the singers from BYU Vocal Point. And then they also had Young Men General President Stephen J. Lund and Sister Suarez speak, and Elder Suarez speak, and there were quite a few testimonies born. So it sounds like it was a lovely event and an exciting thing to look forward to for youth who might be feeling somewhat confused and lost during this time. Today I was just talking with my family about some of the effects of COVID-19 and how it's changed church, and how it might be easy to lose some people as we transition back to regular church, because I certainly loved the convenience of home church. But we talked about how one of the hardest struggle points might be for the youth, because a lot of wards, even if they haven't started conducting in-person sessions yet, have started doing like Zoom Sunday school lessons as opportunities to get together as a ward. And the children might be playing in the background, and, you know, they're having... doing whatever little toddlers do, trying to just stay still in these meetings. But a lot of the youth might not be participating because, you know, they don't necessarily want to be in an adult Sunday school, but not all wards are doing, like, young men and young women Zoom meetings all the time, and it's hard to do so right now. And so I do feel for the youth right now, it being in a more challenging situation. And so I think it's a wonderful thing that the church made this event specifically for the youth to give them some hope, something to look forward to, and something inspiring but entertaining at the same time.
And, you know, I think part of the challenge with the youth, I mean, you could try to do like a Zoom youth Sunday school or something, but I'm going to wager you're not going to get a lot of participation. I'm going to be a little frank here for a moment. I don't want to undersell the wonderful youth we have throughout the church, but let's just be honest for a second. A big part of what attract, like, keeps them coming to church is there's a social component to it. There's, you know, you're going to have that second hour with your friends, and you're going to, you know, be able to spend time with them. And so you lose that social component. It is really hard to know how to effectively engage the youth without that, I think.
Yeah, a challenge for sure, but sounds like the church did a great thing in organizing that.
And for our listeners' benefit, the promised arrival of Spencer Marsh
has
I promised your arrival.
You should have done that.
I laid my credibility, my prophetic credibility on the line. No. Oh, maybe not by that anyhow. By my regular association with you, however. No, we're just talking about
the Youth Music Festival.
Yeah.
Did you watch it?
I actually did watch part.
Oh, good. I have not watched it, so maybe you can tell us what your highlight, your favorite part was.
Well, I'm not gonna. I'm
going to guess we don't have a lot of youth in our audience, so...
No, get him closer to the microphone before he talks. Get Spencer closer to the microphone. Okay. Only barely. Yeah. We want to hear you barely, not barely.
Let me hear with Jasmine here.
Share with there you go. That's better.
All right. Hey, is that a little better?
Yes.
Perfect. Yeah, so I just think that it was great to hear from a number of different youth. I think that... Latter-day Saint music has kind of faded in popularity a little bit over the past couple decades, actually, in the past few years. And so it's great to kind of see a surge of music, and especially of spiritual music, written by youth for youth to kind of create and inspire and to motivate and to integrate more youthful, more modern voices into proclaiming the gospel. And so... A really powerful event. It was hosted by Yehosh Bonner, and you have appearances from other members of the Bonner family. Go check it out. I think it's on YouTube right now, so you're able to watch it. It is a little bit long.
Question. Was there... what was the impetus for this besides, coronavirus? Was there maybe any, first vision theme to it or something like that?
Not that I noticed. Not that I noticed.
That's kind of a bummer, because I know that... That one of the ways they actually celebrated the centennial of the first vision, the 100 year celebration, was they had poetry readings, and I think they had music. I think they had music festivals and stuff like that. They did a bunch of stuff to celebrate, and the coronavirus has, I don't know what we may have had planned that got dampened by the coronavirus, and we haven't been able to do, or if maybe this general conference was all there was going to be anyway, but. But yeah, sounds like a great event. Definitely worth checking out.
And then also this week, the church announced that they opened up the Salt Lake Temple Time Capsule. This was pretty exciting. So in 1892, well, 1893 was when the Salt Lake Temple was dedicated. But in 1892, they put the capstone in place and put the Angel Moroni on top. And so the capstone is the giant ball that sits underneath Angel Moroni's statue on the pinnacle of the Salt Lake Temple. And inside that, they placed some items of historic significance for opening at some later date. And so since they are renovating the temple, they took a peek inside and essentially excavated the time capsule, which was difficult to do. And they're not even entirely done yet, because inside the time capsule, it's a granite ball, but they also filled it with cement afterwards, so it's a very excavation of these documents and items they put in. So some of the things that they found inside, there's nothing jaw-dropping or groundbreaking like a lost 116-page manuscript or anything, but there were items that were...
Hey, look, they put the plates just right here.
But there were some interesting things. There was The Voice of Warning by Parley P. Pratt. There's a few pieces of literature. Key to the Science of Theology by Parley P. Pratt. A copy of the Book of Mormon. Copy of the Pearl of Great Price. The Martyrs. A Sketch of the Lives of a Full Account of the Martyrdom of Joseph and Hiram Smith by Lyman O. Littlefield. And then there was an unidentified book and an unidentifiable paper that just through time was too corroded. There also was a Bible. Orson Spencer's letters, which had correspondences with the Reverend William Cowell explaining the church's doctrine, and some more unidentifiable books. And there was a gold-leafed copper plate inscribed with Holiness to the Lord, with notable dates in the Salt Lake Temple construction, which is kind of cool. It actually reminds me of the high priest's plate that the Israelite high priest would wear that said Holiness to the Lord. There were some photographs of the construction of the temple. There also were some coins, mostly pretty common coins, just like a half dime, 3 cent piece, 6 pence, 3 pence. Just a few coins to represent the population living in Utah at the time. And Let's see. And that's about it. And there also were a few commemorative coins as well, some special collector's coins. But that's it they've found so far. But like I said, they're still digging through and trying to get the last few coins out of there since it is quite the process. But that's pretty fun from a historic standpoint to see what did the Saints of 1892 think was important enough but small enough to preserve as a message and a memorial to who they were, what they thought, what they believed at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. There's never anything groundbreaking in a time capsule, let's be honest. You put some fairly common everyday items in, so... Well, that was less a...
That was not in the temple.
That wasn't a time capsule, per se.
Yeah.
It also didn't go very well, if I recall.
And yeah, that one... You know, maybe they could have put cement in that one. That might have helped, actually.
Yeah, this is my question, is that, like, they put some rather common items, it seems, in this structure, but then they filled it in with cement. It doesn't seem that they wanted... Did they want these items to be found, or did we... Is this really a time capsule? A moment? Is there really a moment in time that this was supposed to be open, or was this kind of just a commemorative way of leaving a part of the saint's heart with the temple? I don't know. That was my biggest question, was kind of what the purpose might have been behind their leaving these items.
Yeah, I think it's more the latter than the former. I can't remember if there was a specific date. I mean, what date did they even put the time capsule together? Do you remember?
1892, April 6th. Yeah, April 6th, 1892.
Okay,
at the capstone.
So we passed the 100-year mark, which I don't think what are we, the 118? No, we're more than that, 128 years after the fact. I don't think that was the date they marked for it, I'll tell you that much. I think it was mostly just, to put a little piece of who they were and what the world was like in there. I don't know if they had an inventory of what was in there before they opened it or not, but that's kind of the fun of it. If you don't have a list of what's in there, so you don't know what's coming, there is a little bit of fun in opening up and finding out. But
it sounds like they had the apostles empty their pockets into the thing.
and
like,
they apparently
I've got a pamphlet
much.
Here. Okay. Oh, here's some change.
Oh, that would be funny if that's what really did happen. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Nope, you're
okay.
Going to change
so, I think what this teaches us is that the modern church is still trying to catch up to the Nephites in the area of time capsules.
Hmm.
Like, the Nephites, they seal up the golden plates,
yeah.
and have them, like, presented to our dispensation by an angel.
Yeah, they did time capsules a little better back then,
yeah.
It sounds like. Not only do they have an angel that, presents it, but... Apparently, the items preserved quite well, so...
Yeah!
You know, they
also had a sword! That's a lot cooler!
Yeah, and pretty cool stuff. I think part of it is they just had cooler stuff back then. I mean, it's
like,
just the way it was.
In fairness to our dispensation, though, we weren't trying to, like, preserve the last remnants of our culture.
True.
It was kind of for fun. It wasn't as much, I'm going to use these items to open the next dispensation. So I think there were a little bit different expectations, perhaps, also going into it than Moroni's project.
It's true.
Absolutely.
Though, nonetheless, I always find time capsule openings very interesting. I think it's fun to reflect upon, what I think would be most important to preserve if archaeologists were excavating my house 1,000 years from now. Sometimes I think about that and wonder, what would they think if they excavated my bedroom or my kitchen or my house? You know, what things am I leaving behind that would communicate what was important to me?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And it's honestly one I think that is useful to reflect on. Granted, a lot of the things you might then subsequently decorate your house with to consider how the message you'd be sending might not survive and be recognizable to an archaeologist a long time ago. But
have any of you read Motel of the Mysteries?
Yeah. Wait, what was that?
Motel of the Mysteries. It's a book about a motel that gets excavated by archaeologists far in the future. They conclude everything is a religious item,
especially
the toilet paper points.
You
make offerings into the toilet bowl and everything. Yeah.
I thought you said Red Motel of Mysteries. I thought.
Oh no no.
Maybe
that was the book Motel of the Mysteries.
There was a hotel chain or something out there. I don't know.
No.
I think it is worth considering. How are you? What are you doing in your home to mark it as a sacred space on some level, and to show what's important to you? That if someone were to excavate it 1,000 years from now and everything were miraculously preserved, would they know what was important to you?
Right, and just where do you keep the things that are most important? A lot of people have a fire safe so that if there's ever fire to their homes, that they're most important, like, government documents aren't destroyed, the deed to their home, their passports, their birth certificates. My father is an immigrant from Argentina, and so he, you know, went through that sifting process of figuring out what he could bring with him, much like the pioneers in Utah did. You know, they have to decide what's the most important thing, and he ended up having all of his luggage lost, and so that was quite the tragedy. But, you know, in that suitcase that ended up getting lost, he carried with him some of the more sentimental items he always wanted to preserve, and you know, that's not tragedy at all. But, you know, I'm sure some airport security or luggage person is enjoying them quite a bit right now. But it's just a great exercise to think, what's the most important? What do you want to preserve? What do you want your generations after you to keep hold of? In other perhaps more significant news, or at least prescient news, is the church updated the general handbook this week, with the significant updates to 5 chapters and minor revisions to 10 others. And a lot of them are, nothing's groundbreaking. We don't have any new revelation or doctrine coming out, but some interesting things that could impact how we serve in the church, and I think some of them are interesting, one of which is Sunday school. They've made organizational changes so that the bishop can determine whether or not they need to call counselors to the Sunday school presidency. In the past, we've had a Sunday school president and 2 counselors and sometimes a secretary, but now they're kind of just leaving it up to the discretion of the bishop if you just want to have a Sunday school president and he just runs the show. And that's probably wise, since in a lot of wards there's not a huge need, especially now that we've condensed Sunday school a lot. We no longer have institutionally gospel principles, gospel doctrine, temple prep, and all these other classes that you could have. We're all just doing come follow me unless there's a specific need. So that's interesting. They made some changes about birth control and...
What did they say?
It says...
Well, they said you should not be taking it, Hales.
The church continues to discourage sperm donations. They've also extended that now to egg donations. They also talked about surgical sterilization. In the past, the church has discouraged surgical sterilization, but they say in this new update that section has been removed. The church still continues to discourage surgical sterilization as an elective form of birth control, but also notes that husbands and wives are encouraged to counsel together when considering permanent birth control options. So,
yeah, the most interesting thing about the language is that it went from the church strongly discourages these things to just the church discourages these things. I think that was the... kind of the big, that was the big shift for a lot of these regarding reproductive health and so forth. But then they have other sections here, like on the occult and medical marijuana.
Yeah, what I thought about birth was the surrogate motherhood, and I don't know if any of you guys have the answer, but the manual now says that now includes a long-standing policy that children born to a surrogate mother can be sealed to parents in a temple only with first presidency approval. Bishops are counseled to provide ecclesiastical support and to help members obtain immediate professional help as needed. So before, was it always required for first presidency approval to get sealed to a surrogate if your child is born through a surrogate?
I honestly do not know.
Interesting. I've never thought of it.
I don't know.
That is an interesting... I imagine the intent there is they largely just want to make sure that there are no complications with the involvement of the surrogate. You know, I don't know that much about this kind of thing, though I did do some research on it a number of years ago. And, you know, you do got to be careful. You know, the church discourages surrogacy and what have you. And it's really sometimes that's the last option people come to, though, and it's all that's left. They just want to make sure that, you know, a bond can be formed between the baby and the surrogate mother. And sometimes if they're not stable or whatever, they may be interfering or complicating the relationship of the parents and the child in various ways. And so I think I'm assuming it's largely to just make sure there aren't any complications like that. But I would
imagine it's just because a lot of complicated cases could come up in that general scenario. And so they want the highest level of
review,
scrutiny and guidance, basically.
Yeah.
They also added a section on sex education where they just add a little thing that encourages parents to have honest, clear, and respectful conversations with their children about sexuality and to make sure that their children are aware and they're seeking influence on sex education in the home rather than outside sources. And they also have a section on medical marijuana, and it says the church opposes the use of marijuana for non-medical purposes. And they have a little thing on the occult saying that the occult, not limited to, but including Satan worship, fortune telling, curses, and healing practices that are imitations of the priesthood power are not allowed or not tolerated. So interesting stuff, and there's quite a few other things in the manual that you can check out yourself. Personally, I think it's interesting that the church is publicizing these updates in the first place. I know in 2015 there was quite a big hubbub around the November policy, which had a statement about the children of same-sex parents, and I don't know if that influences this or not, or is this just the direction the church is going, but since then they've announced every time they've made changes to the manual, and I think it's interesting. It was certainly fun to go through and peruse and see the different changes and wonder what the implications might be in our day-to-day discipleship. So, fun.
One thing I think actually goes into that is the fact that, you know, we got to this point because they rolled out a new manual a few months ago that is completely public and accessible, whereas before there was, you know, Handbook 1, Handbook, and Handbook 2. Handbook 2, public and accessible. Handbook 1, not so much. Now that the whole thing's public and accessible, you know, anytime you make changes, that's, you know,
public
kind of... Yeah, it's public knowledge. And so there's... I do think that there's a PR strategy here that especially when there may be something controversial or whatever the case may be, it makes sure the church is able to kind of get out ahead of the story. But there's also just kind of this sense that now that it's a public handbook, this is public knowledge, and you know, we should notify the public.
Well, it gets rid of the criticism that the church is, you know, not transparent, or the church is trying to kind of keep certain knowledge just for the higher ups, just for the mucky mucks. And it kind of takes away some of the teeth from that criticism.
And any kind of criticism that might be like, oh, sure, they made the handbook public, but then they're quietly and silently making all these changes to it all the time.
Right, like, exactly.
Who's memorized the whole handbook kind of thing? So it's like, no, they're not doing that. They're being very transparent, and every time they make changes, they're letting you know.
It's a good policy on a number of levels.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that probably covers it for kind of the news around the church this last week. We can go ahead. We've got several things on the docket today that we could talk about. There's the FAIR conference coming up, of course. I don't want to quite hit on that just yet because that's a, you know, that'll suck up all the time we have because we always have a lot to say about that. Before we jump into that, I actually thought it'd be nice to highlight three new books that I think will be of interest to fans of the Interpreter Show and fans of the Interpreter in particular, one of which is actually an Interpreter book. Interpreter came out with, was it this week or last week that they released it? It was last week. Interpreter released... the volume 4 of the Temple on Mount Zion series. These volumes are the proceedings of the Temple on Mount Zion conference they hold every other year. In fact, they will be holding one this year. Is it November? In fact, Jasmine will be presenting at that, so everyone should look forward to at least her presentation with the utmost excitement. But these are the proceedings of the fourth conference that they held, volume four to that. It's called Sacred Time, Sacred Space, and Sacred Meaning. As you can tell from the name, the Temple on Mount Zion series, it focuses on the ancient temple, as has every volume in this series up to this point. Only four papers in this one, but it's still a pretty hefty volume, thanks to our good friend Jeff Bradshaw and a very substantive paper that he produced for that.
200 pages.
Jeff is great, and he's always very thorough, and so I'm always eager to see what he has to say. But his paper, like I said, like Jasmine mentioned, it's in the ballpark of 200 pages. It's called By the Blood Ye Are Sanctified, the Symbolic, Salvific, Interrelated, Additive, Retrospective, and Anticipatory Nature of the Ordinances of Ritual Birth in John 3 and Moses. So, it's a very long paper. I haven't read it yet, but it does sound very interesting. I actually thought the one that sounded most interesting for this particular volume, though, was the one from Camille Franck Olson, Women in Public Worship in Ancient Israel. I don't think we get enough attention paid to women and the temple in antiquity, and so I think that's I haven't read it yet, but I really look forward to seeing what she had to say.
I haven't read the printed paper, but I watched her presentation, and it really is quite lovely. And she talks about how the main role of women in the temple in ancient Israel was in a music capacity. They were the ones in charge of playing the taf and the drum and mostly percussive instruments. But there might have been some melodic ones as well in the procession. As Israel gathers at the temple, the women were the ones who were expected to provide music. And as a musician myself, I love that. I love the idea that the song of the heart is a prayer unto the Lord, and that's a very powerful way to communicate worship. And that was a responsibility and the stewardship of the feminine in ancient Israel. I loved it.
That does sound lovely. And, I think one thing that is really hard to appreciate, particularly because it's hard to replicate, we can dig up artifacts and take pictures of them and show them off, and we can translate texts so that you can read and have at least some level of comprehension of what they were saying and communicating to one another. But it's very, very hard to capture the music and the sounds of the ancient world and how they might have used music to affect the ambiance of a setting and create a sacred space. And that's actually very interesting. Just to round out our discussion and mention the other two papers that are in there that might be of interest to you. Well, the other two papers that are in there, and hopefully all of them sound interesting to you. But there's also The Choreography of Genesis, which is subtitled The Book of Abraham as a Ritual Text by David Calabro. David Calabro is he has a doctorate in either ancient Near Eastern studies or Semitics or something along that line. He's also studied Egyptian at the University of Chicago. He's a very, very good scholar there. I'm very excited to see him. This is the first thing of his that I'm aware of, at least, on the Book of Abraham. So I'm excited to see him starting to engage that text. And then the last one from one of my favorite scholars, actually, Matthew Bowen, Where I Will Meet You, The Convergence of Sacred Time and Sacred Space as an Etiological Function of the Tent of Meeting. So sounds like that might have kind of been the title track, if you will. It's got sacred time and space in there. If any of that sounds interesting to you, if you want to learn and understand the temple better, and I do stress these people are talking about ancient temple ritual and practice, but I promise you, if you read it and you study it, you'll realize that has a lot to do with what we do in the temple today, and it'll shed a lot of light on your temple worship. But if that's of any interest to you, that's published just this last week by the Interpreter Foundation. It's available on Amazon.com for purchase. Another book, we'll just touch on this, these other two quickly here, but another book that I think will be of interest to a lot of people that came out just this last week here, July 27th was its release date, is a book by Donald W. Perry, Preserved in Translation, Hebrew and Other Literary Forms in the Book of Mormon. And if any of you have heard of the term Hebraisms before, that's a lot of what Brother Perry here is talking about. Don Perry, for what it's worth, is a Hebrew professor at BYU, and he's been a Hebrew professor there for close to 30 years, I think. And he has extensive experience in reading and analyzing and studying Hebrew text, and he's on the international team for the Dead Sea Scrolls, and has many publications in academic venues on the Bible and the Dead Sea Scrolls and the like, where he's constantly analyzing the nuances of Hebrew language. So he's quite the expert in terms of the linguistics of Hebrew and things like that. And he's read the Book of Mormon, the English of the Book of Mormon, very closely and identified a number of examples where the English is more Hebrew-like, more Hebraic than what would be the typical expectation of expression in English. And this is something a lot of people have done over the years, but it's very interesting to see what Brother Perry has to say with his experience and background on that subject. And it's also a very light read, for what it's worth. It's only about 150 pages, so...
And when we talk about Hebraism, an example might be something like, in the Book of Mormon, it talks about bloodsheds. And bloodsheds, in English, we would only use the singular. We would say something like, and there was a lot of bloodshed. But in Hebrew, there's a thing called plural amplification in their grammar. And so to pluralize something is to magnify it and to make it more emphatic. So if you're talking about there's a lot of bloodshed, you say bloodsheds. And so that's just an example of something that is... It's something in the grammar that
right.
is very Hebrew-ish that you wouldn't expect in English, and that sounds like bad English, but is actually perfectly appropriate Hebrew.
And he does talk about plural amplification in the book, and that's actually one of the interesting things about that example. Some of the examples he's talking about are things that you can find in the King James Bible, and so people will be like, oh, he's just borrowing or whatever. But that's an example where English translations, including the King James Version, typically do not translate. The plural doesn't come through translation. They filter that out as they translate it. So that's something where we do have some examples of that in the Book of Mormon, and it's not something that Joseph Smith could have just taken from the King James Bible. Other examples, like I said, can be found in the King James Bible. Some of them are things that, you know, it's not impossible to express yourself that way in English, but it's not quite as common. And an example that you probably don't ever think about, but you hear it all the time, is when we talk about Lehi's dream, what do the people hold? The iron rod. But what does the text actually say?
The rod of iron?
The rod of iron. Okay, and that's the more Hebraic construct. Now,
also the fruit, but I guess, anyways.
Yeah. And is it impossible for rod of iron in English? Well, no, that's not an impossible or super awkward way of articulating it, but it's not what comes most instinctively or naturally to English speakers. Yeah, English speakers.
I'm having trouble with English right now.
It's not what comes most naturally, and that was the case even in Joseph Smith's day. So there are 30 chapters in this book. They're all very short. You don't have to, you can sit down for just a few minutes when you got time here and there and learn a little something new about the Book of Mormon as you go through that book.
Cool.
Last one that I want to mention is, it's actually been available online for a few weeks, but it's officially available in print now. It is the, proceedings of the Chiasmus Conference that was hosted, at BYU in 2017. It's called Chiasmus, the State of the Art. It is edited by John W. Welch and Donald W. Perry again. And I've got a physical copy here in the studio, so now Spencer thinks he can, you know, get his grubby little hands on it. But no, you're fine. It's actually a really fascinating volume. The conference was held to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Chiasmus being discovered in the Book of Mormon. But the scholars who came to participate in the conference were not all Latter-day Saints. And it was really a pretty fun conference. We had scholars like Gary Rensburg, and I know these names may not mean a lot of people here, but Gary Rensburg and Stephen Scott and Jonathan Burnside and Bernard Levinson, all some of the very best biblical scholars out there. And they came and they talked about some of their own work in Chiasmus and in biblical studies. There was a really interesting paper by Kerry Hull on Chiasmus in ancient Mayan texts. And that's something that's not a groundbreaking discovery. In fact, there was a groundbreaking discovery of Chiasmus in Mayan texts back in the 80s, and it was done by a Latter-day Saint named Alan Christensen. And it's since been widely accepted that Chiasmus is a feature of Mayan writing, and Kerry Hull, who is a BYU professor, but he's not talking about the Book of Mormon or anything, he's just highlighting all the examples you can find in Mayan texts.
Does it function similarly in Mayan text, like where it has a rhetorical usage to emphasize primarily a central point and contrast of relationships between elements the way it does in other ancient literatures?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Kerry Hull illustrates a number of ways that it functions. It does function differently a little bit. And it doesn't necessarily have all those same kind of features, but it does do some of those things. It draws attention to the central element still. That's a common feature. Okay. One thing, the Maya would get really playful with it in some cases, and they'd layer it with additional structural features. And then what they'd actually do, there's one example is Stela C at Quirigua is actually a really interesting example of chiasmus because it goes A, B, C, 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 A, B. So there's actually three elements, a triplet in the middle rather than a doublet like you'd expect. What's particularly interesting about that triplet in the middle, though, is it's broken down. Each element of the three center elements are broken down into a triplet of their own that goes A, B, C, A, B, C, and then B, A, C. And so they change the order sometimes as a means of drawing attention to particular figures. And that's actually something Ian Thompson has talked about, a similar thing happening in the Pauline letters, where sometimes Paul will sketch out a chiasm, but then break from the order in one instance to draw attention to that particular feature. So there's some interesting things that are kind of unique among the Maya, but there's also similar patterns that you can find in other places. What I can tell you is that while there are differences in the way the Maya use chiasmus and these kind of structuring devices from the biblical world, there are similarities in both the Mayan poetics and chiasmus in particular, and some of the features we see in the Book of Mormon. For example, that example I just gave you of A, B, C, 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 B, A, there's a chiasm
almost
like that.
Almost 36 does it, doesn't he?
What's that?
Doesn't Alma 36 do that at one point?
It's not Alma 36. Alma 29, actually.
Oh, 29?
There's a chiasm, actually. This is what gets me the most. There's a chiasm in Alma 29 that goes A, B, C, 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 B, A, and the three C's in the middle break down into three triplets.
Oh, wow.
And there's a no-why on Book of Mormon Central about that. So that's, like I said, Kerry Hull doesn't go into any of this stuff. But if you read it and you study what we know about chiasmus in the Book of Mormon, there are some interesting similarities to how it functioned among the Maya, and how it appears to function in the Book of Mormon.
Okay.
One of the more interesting papers in this volume, though, that I recently read was the one by David Rolfe Seeley, because he's looking at, he specifically is looking at how chiasmus is used in 7th century BC Israel. And he identifies four specific ways that they would use chiasmus that are, it's not just like here's more examples of chiasmus. These are distinct functions that they would use chiasmus for that you wouldn't intuitively recognize if you're just reading the Bible. You're not even going to intuitively recognize the chiasms themselves, let alone what they're doing rhetorically with the thing. And then David Rolf Seeley, who is a Latter-day Saint and does talk about the Book of Mormon in his paper, he actually shows that all four of those different functions of chiasm show up in the Book of Mormon. So I thought that was pretty neat. That's everything. If you want to check that one out, the print volumes will be available for sale through Book of Mormon Central and Amazon in the very near future. I don't think we've got it up just yet. But if you want to go El Cheapo and just read it for free online, it is available online via BYU Studies, actually. So byustudies.byu.edu. It's called Volume 59 Supplemental Chiasmus. On BYU Studies, it's being portrayed as another volume of the journal, and it was sent out to all the subscribers as such. But it's also being made available as a print book, not an issue of the journal. And that's what you can purchase via Book of Mormon Central. So those are just, like I said, I wanted to just highlight those books really quickly. We've maybe got 15 minutes or so left before we need to go to our Come Follow Me portion. Should we jump in to the...
Let's talk about Fair Mormon this year.
The Fair Mormon Conference.
And as Spencer is our most involved volunteer with Fair Mormon, I'm wondering if you could maybe tell us a little bit about it this week.
Oh, boy. So due to coronavirus restrictions, they will be having the entire conference online this year. You can pay for streaming for the conference. It costs about $60. So hopefully you guys have all been saving your pennies for this. It might be like a little expensive for some, but I'm sure it's going to be really fun. We have a lot of great speakers this year. For instance, a couple of my favorites that I'm just seeing right off the top here. Our friend Tim Barker is going to be presenting on the Book of Abraham. Going to be presenting a little bit on the hypocephalus. Valerie Hudson, who's a fantastic speaker. She is she's going to be talking about the first political order and the priesthood. I have actually no idea what this is referring to. I just love Valerie Hudson. I'm a big fan of Valerie Hudson. So.
She's phenomenal.
She does some good stuff.
Yeah.
She's awesome. We're a little super presentation from Carrie Muehlstein. He's going to be presenting on the translation of the Book of Abraham. I think he's going to be presenting on the Kirtland Gibson papers and their relationship to the Book of Abraham. And that should be pretty exciting because he's been doing work on this, and he recently gave a presentation on this at the Joseph Smith Papers Conference about in 2018,
I think.
So 2 years ago. So this will be some more findings from him, and that'll be exciting. Mark Asheris McGee, he is a historian with the Church History Department, is going to be presenting on the Adam Clark accusation and the JST. For those of
let's just give a quick rundown on this. If you haven't heard online, there's been a lot of hullabaloo, if you will, to use an old person word here.
Hullabaloo.
My British old person word.
I'm sorry.
Wow, you are sick in your 60s.
I'm getting up there. But there's been a lot of chatter about this discovery of the use of the Adam Clark Bible Commentary, which was a popular Bible commentary in the 1820s and 30s. The use of that Bible commentary in the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible. The paper came out. It was co-written by Tom Waymont and one of his research assistants. And in the process of writing the paper, his research assistant lost faith. And so she's been going on all these podcasts and saying Joseph Smith plagiarized Adam Clark. Tom Waymont has never said that. And if the paper itself does not claim that either. It's just That's how she's been interpreting it.
Right.
And it's caused quite a bit of consternation for a lot of people who are struggling and things like that. So Mark Ashurst McGee, who's a very... I've never met Mark. I've seen him in a few conferences, but I don't think he would know me from Adam.
Yeah.
Adam Clark, even.
Yeah. I have met Mark in person. We just haven't. I guarantee, though, that if I were to approach him today and say, "Hey, I'm Spencer Marsh. Do you remember me?" He'd probably say,
sure.
"No, who the heck are you, weirdo? Go away."
But,
right.
So, but I have read.
I haven't met him, but his dissertation was good.
Yeah. Well, it was his master's thesis that.
Yeah.
Master's thesis. Yeah.
Pathway to Prophethood.
The one on the Sealer Stones.
Very, very good. I've read several of the papers he's written. He does really good work. Really faithful work. I really love what he does, and so I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, what he has to say about this and how he can maybe help us contextualize this and process what's really going on with the Joseph Smith translation a little bit.
The last two of these presentations that I was really excited about was one from Jennifer Roach. For those of you who don't know who Jennifer Roach is, she's a recent convert from the Anglican faith. She was actually ordained as a priest within ordained clergy within the Anglican Church, and she converted to the church, I believe it was last year, and she's phenomenal. She's already very well studied on the apologetics of the church and knows a lot of the scholars, and she's made quite a big splash, and we like her a lot. She's got a great personality. She's gonna be talking about private bishop interviews as a protective factor, why LDS teens benefit from a few moments alone with their bishops. That's going to be interesting to hear her address those controversies.
That's another big controversial topic there. And for what it's worth, I understand Jennifer, not only was she a member of the Anglican clergy, but she actually is a practicing therapist or psychiatrist or something like that. For I think either I think sex abuse victims, actually,
former sex workers and sex abuse victims.
So she's got the credentials to tackle a topic like this.
Yes, very much so.
And I know just a little bit about what she's going to say. I don't really know, and I'm looking forward to really hearing what she has to say. But from what I understand, she is going
to
be talking about how contrary to what has been popularly portrayed by certain opportunists on the internet.
Yes.
These kinds of things are actually very good for youth and are more likely to be helping to protect and prevent and catch abuse than to be causing abuse.
Right.
And that's an interesting point worth making, that many times when people start agitating something or other, they have so little knowledge of what they're actually speaking and don't recognize either the purpose for which a thing exists or the harm that they can do, that they are doing by interfering with it.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
If you ask me, I would put activism right up there with the seven deadly sins. But
oh boy.
Thou shalt not commit activism.
I'm just kidding, and obviously there are a lot of good, worthy causes to be an activist for, and so I'm joking, but I do agree that you can often lose sight of big picture issues when you become too narrowly focused on a particular topic.
Right.
Well, political methods don't belong in Zion in the same way. Anyway.
Sure.
Last one I was really excited about that we'll talk about here. Daniel Peterson is obviously probably always going to be the concluding speaker at the Fair Mormon Conference, but yet again, he is the concluding speaker at the Fair Mormon Conference, and I don't know why I mentioned that. So he's going to be talking about Book of Mormon. The title of his presentation is Book of Mormon, The Book of Mormon Witnesses, Variety and Complexity. Now, Daniel has been currently working on a big project with the Interpreter Foundation to come out with a dramatic dramatic 2-hour film. Is it a documentary or
it's like
is
a docudrama?
Yeah. A docudrama.
And from conversations I've had with Dan, I don't know where the project stands now, but at least some point along the stage of development, the plan was to have the docudrama portion, but also a more straightforward documentary that would be available as well. And there was one of the main goals with the documentary side of things was to make sure every question, every legitimate question, every substantive question about the witnesses is answered by somebody who has credentials, who has studied this, who's a scholar, and has done a lot of work on this.
So that's definitely what I'm most excited for. And it was cool to see Dan like ask people online, like, "Hey, give us every criticism you've ever heard of the witnesses.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to answer it." You know? And I imagine that this will go along very similarly with his work.
If I had to make a prediction, he's been saying fall 2020 for the release of all of this.
Yeah, I don't know. That sounds kind of upper, yeah.
Well, if I had to make
sounds optimistic.
If I had to make a prediction, I'd guess he maybe is planning to even unveil it right here. This is a little early.
That would be consistent. I mean, he did like unveil the Interpreter Foundation at the Fair Conference.
Yeah.
That's true. He did.
So anyway, that's a possibility. You're going to have to buy your live streaming ticket and watch for yourself to find out if that's what really happens. Now, with our last few minutes, Hales, I believe you wanted to talk about the latest interpreter paper.
Well, the latest interpreter paper is by Brian Hales, and it responds to the...
Could we just maybe call this segment Hales on Hales real quick?
Oh, my goodness. This is the trouble of having the same given name as the last name of somebody who does really awesome, excellent work. Anyway, Brian is a first-class historian, and he wrote a response to a paper basically claiming that all of the visionary experiences in the early Latter-day Saint tradition were the result of entheogens, which are hallucinogens.
Mushrooms.
These are your magic mushrooms and so forth.
Peyote and things like that.
All of which we do not believe in partaking, to be very, very clear.
Yeah, what was that update to the handbook?
Yeah. So we managed to get our with my opening quips, we managed to tie this together rather nicely. I'm going to take a moment and say what my refutation of that would have been instead of what Brian's was. Though, if you want the like a very good scholarly treatment of why their claims really don't wash very well historically, this is the place to go. But I would say the simple reason why is that one of their fundamental claims is that vision ceased effectively after the founding generation. And the simple response to it is no such thing is true. Visions have not ceased in this church. Neither have any of the substantive gifts of the Spirit. We enjoy these just as much in our day as they did in that day. And if you could get a straight answer out of every member of the church, you could go to virtually any congregation of substantive size. Maybe if we're talking like six or fewer, you might run into some quirky ones. But and find people that have had experiences of the same type and quality as those described in the founding generation of the church. Now they would largely be for the purposes of personal guidance and edification, rather than things like restoring priesthood keys, because the Lord already accomplished that.
Right.
But and the fundamental criticism is basically just based on people's ignorance of the experiences of those around them. And it preys on that. It's cheap criticism for that reason. Anyway.
To your point, I can tell you. And I think you're right. I also think for the most part, if you tried that, you wouldn't get very many people who were actually forthcoming about their experiences.
Yeah,
but I will
exactly
say,
true.
When I was a missionary, you know, missionaries, I think, have the opportunity to get to know ward members, if you're a good missionary, a lot better than even ward members themselves sometimes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have the opportunity to be in their homes frequently. And I heard many, many stories, and these were not crazy people. These were not like the people who are out there on the fringes of fundamentalism in the church or whatever. These were ordinary, everyday people. They were bright, they were intelligent, and I heard all kinds
of powerful stories about miracles, about visions, about prophecies even. Conversion stories that involved those kinds of things. I mean, it was absolutely stunning, and you can find them today if you know where, if you know who to talk to.
I would say also, just as a point, you know, not only is it kind of ignorant, but I think that just on the fundamental level, we're talking about experiences that give you knowledge of something that you wouldn't otherwise have, right?
Mm-hmm.
These are experiences, mm-hmm. even just spiritual experiences in general, right? These are experiences where, you know, even today, apologists and critics are still debating the origins of the Book of Mormon, right? Because Joseph Smith has left all the, has left, you know, this trail of breadcrumbs, apparently, and he's been on the run for 200 years, this con man. But I mean, you know, all these things kind of keep appearing that show, that vindicate him, you know, that give evidences of his inspiration. And, you know, this is knowledge that he could not have otherwise had unless another being prior to him had had that experience that he could then relay to Joseph, to back to Joseph Smith. So, you know, that would be my basic, you know, two-line response is that, you know, if we're really going to attribute these to just drugs, to just entheogenic drugs, where you just experience this rapturous type thing, I mean, you still have to account for what, for the knowledge. You still have to account for the knowledge that these agents would not have otherwise had they not claimed to have had these experiences.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I just want to say something to the disingenuousness of the paper in and of itself. Not Brian Hales' paper. Read that.
Yeah.
The original paper, which goes under this pretense of we're not trying to undercut Latter-day Saint belief, but rather,
well, we kind of are, though.
But
know?
Yeah, they do this thing where they're kind of like, if we understand, you know, understand the proper place that entheogenic substances have had in the faith, and maybe restore them to that proper place, like kind of like, hey,
you like want to have like drugs.
You should use psychedelic drugs in the Latter-day Saint Church because that's a fundamental part of your tradition. And you know, we're just trying to help you understand where your own visions came from is kind of the, like, come on, you know full well that that's not, that absolutely impacts the claims we're making. And drugs as a medium to actual encounters with something external to yourself are not, that's not really what's going on, right? But anyway.
Basically, drugs do not produce the experiences.
Right.
Simply do not produce the experiences that are described.
I can't summon God into my presence by merely ingesting mushrooms, right? That's not how... Nor can those elevate me to his presence, for that matter. That's just not how it works, right? If we believe that Joseph Smith was in the grove and actually was in God's presence while he was there... then that had nothing to do with any kind of drugs or psychedelic agents.
So what you're saying is there is no stairway to heaven. It's like that sign in Wayne's World. Anyway.
I do suppose maybe I am saying something along those lines.
Yeah. Anyway.
Is there anything else we'd like to cover where we maybe have a minute or two before we get interrupted by the... By the intro or outro, the thing that happens, you know.
The musical ambush.
The musical ambush. I'm sure, you know, if we don't, we can just get started and we can get started on our Come Follow Me. And it'll come when it comes. Okay. Well,
like a thief in the night.
It looks like we don't have nothing else. So why don't we go ahead and start on our Come Follow Me portion of the show. This week we will be talking about the lesson covering Helaman 13 through 16, which is, of course, Samuel the Lamanite. And Jasmine, would you like to start off with giving us a little bit of an overview of that?
Sure thing. So Samuel the Lamanite's narrative is pretty well known, but there's a lot of beautiful complexities to it, and there's a lot that we can talk about this evening. Samuel is introduced first in Helaman chapter 13, and then he spends chapter 13, 14, and 15 filled with prophecies of destruction.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
You got music.
Indeed. With that, let me just give a really quick reintroduction for those who may just be joining us. This is the Interpreter Show. My name is Neil Rapley. I'm joined here in studio by my lovely wife, Jasmine, who was just telling us about Samuel the Lamanite. Spencer Marsh is here with us as well. And Hales is joining us by phone. That's our full lineup these days because the good Mr. Smoot has abandoned us. But with that, Jasmine, why don't you go ahead and continue with Helaman 13 through 16.
As I was saying, Samuel the Lamanite is introduced in Helaman chapter 13 as a Lamanite who's come into the heart of Nephite territory, in the heart of Nephite society, in the city of Zarahemla. He gets upon a wall and he starts prophesying for chapters 13, 14, and 15. He prophesies of destruction of the Nephite civilization. He prophesies of the signs of the birth of Jesus Christ, the sign of the death of Jesus Christ. And he prophesies of woes that will befall the Nephites if they do not repent. And you've got this whole section talking about the ironic contrast between the Lamanites being righteous and the Nephites being wicked. You've got the Lord talking about cursing the land with slipperiness of their treasures. You've got interesting chronological prophecies of Jesus Christ's birth and what that might mean for it's a foreshadowing for Third Nephi, you might say. And then in chapter 16, he ends his prophesying, at which point the majority of those who heard Samuel did not believe. But those who did believe Samuel went to Nephi, the prophet at the time, and were baptized and confessed of their sins and joined the church. And that is the last we hear of Samuel the Lamanite. It says that he was never heard of again, and thus ended the 90-some year, and then thus ended the book of Helaman. So we only get Samuel for a very short time, but at the same time, we get a lot more of him than some other Book of Mormon characters who just are splashed in the pan. But he shows up in chapter 13, says his piece, and then disappears again. So that's kind of a basic overview of where we're at. In we are 5 years before the birth of Christ, so give or take somewhere between 5 and 15 BC, and in the land of Zarahemla, wherever that may be. So at this point, if we want, we can dive straight into chapter 13 and talking about all of our favorite insights and what we can get out of these chapters historically, exegetically, doctrinally, spiritually. I personally found a lot. Does anyone want to go first?
It might make sense, while we're still close to the introductory section, to point out that in some ways, the racial tensions that have gripped America and perhaps other parts of the world recently can in some ways help us appreciate the types of things that are going on here. Samuel represents a substantial reversal. He is the epitome of the outgroup that has been called to minister to the in-group. And this places him in a tremendously awkward position and probably facilitates his rejection by the Nephites. But it also allows the Lord to elevate the rebuke against the Nephites as not just against individuals, but against the way their whole culture has, in a sense, corrupted itself and been lifted up in pride, but failed to realize in themselves the principles of the gospel, whereas the Lamanites have been humble and as a result are now being sent to minister to the Nephites. And like that reversal And the implicit rebuke that's involved in it, I think, is central to the message here.
Right. It is an ironic twist of fate that we've got this. In the night preaching to the Nephites, when there's such heightened tension.
Mm-hmm.
So for the intro of chapter 13, is it starts off telling us that we're in the 86th year, that the Nephites were wicked, and the Lamanites did observe strictly to keep the commandments of God according to the law of Moses. But it came to pass that in this year there was one Samuel, a Lamanite. They make a very strong point to tell you exactly that he is the outgroup, like you said. Came into the land of Zarahemla, the heart of Nephite territory, and began to preach. And it talks about how they didn't accept his preaching, so they cast him out, and he returned to his own land. But behold, the voice of the Lord came to him, that he should return again and prophesy unto the people whatsoever things should come into his heart. And then, because he couldn't come into the city, then he famously climbs upon the wall and stretched forth his hand and cried with a loud voice and prophesied whatsoever things the Lord put into his heart. Now, this was a thing that I was really interested in as I was studying today, and I looked up to see if Matt Bowen has done anything on this, and I was surprised that he hadn't, so maybe I'm just crazy, and there's a reason he hasn't done a paper on this, but Matt Bowen loves onomastics and the etymologies of names, and I was thinking about Samuel and how it's the height of irony that one, Samuel's a Lamanite, and they're the righteous ones, and the Nephites are the wicked ones. But also that Nephi is the prophet at this time, and that their namesake of the Nephites is Nephi himself, and yet they're rejecting him, and they need a Lamanite to come tell them how to do it right. They need Samuel, which also is interesting because Samuel, it is different from Sam, but it is derivative of, possibly, I mean, we don't know because we don't have the underlying text. But it's possibly derivative of Sam, Nephi's brother. And so, I don't know, there might be a little bit of a connection there of needing to have the righteous brother come from the other side to tell them how to do it. But what I was also interested in is Samuel itself, it's a bit contested what the name means. It either could mean name of the Lord, Shem of El, or it could mean the Lord heard, Shema El.
Like Ishmael.
Exactly. It could be either one, but as I was reading and thinking and studying, I thought that maybe the Lord heard might be an appropriate etymology, at least in this narrative context, because the whole thing is about how the Nephites aren't hearing the Lord, and they're not hearing Samuel, and yet the Lord is hearing Samuel. He's on the outside. The Lamanites are the ideological and tribal enemies of the Nephites, and yet they did observe to keep the commandments. And it came to pass that there was a Samuel, a Lamanite, and he began to preach, and he was rejected, and no one heard him. But behold, the voice of the Lord came to him that he should return and then put things in his heart. After the Nephites reject Samuel, the Lord heard Samuel, and he gives him, he equips him with the words that he needs to preach unto the people. And I just thought that was really, really interesting. And I don't know, maybe Matt Bowen should scoop me and write a paper on that.
It sounds like a paper you would write. I like it. I think to amplify your point, later on, he talks about the Nephites, but he doesn't just say the Nephites. He said those who are called the people of Nephi. So they're, in some ways, the Nephites have become false Nephites because they have not heard, or because they've refused to hear the voice of the prophets.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, I don't know if I've got anything substantive to say about it, but one thing that actually stands out to me in these first few verses is the repetition of the word heart. It says in verse 3, it talks about, you know, the voice of the Lord came unto me that he should return again and prophesy unto the people whatsoever things should come into
his
heart. So then in verse 4, it says that he climbed the wall, stretched forth his hand, and cried with a loud voice and prophesied unto people whatsoever things the Lord put into his heart. And it's a near verbatim repetition here. And then Samuel himself in verse 5 as it records what he says. It says, I do speak the words of the Lord which he doth put into my heart. And so this is, there's some kind of emphasis happening here, stressing the act of the Lord in putting the words into his heart. And there's some kind of importance here.
I also think in light of that, it's interesting to notice the gestures. When it talks about how Samuel stretched forth his hand, and this is something that David Calabro has done a lot of work on, but stretching forth one's hand is a gesture of speech. We see that a lot in the ancient world. But it also has some connections to priesthood and priesthood power. It is when Moses stretched forth his hand over the Red Sea that he commanded the waters to part. It is when Nephi stretched forth his hand that he shocked Laman and Lemuel in 1 Nephi 17. And it is when Abinadi stretched forth his hand in the court of King Noah that he was filled with the power of God and they could not touch him. And so whenever you see gestures like that, stretching forth the hand, I think it signifies some connection with the power of God, with priesthood power, that they are invoking prophetic and priesthood authority in giving some sort of message or sign. And in this case, Samuel does both. He is giving the message that the Lord has put into his heart, and he is talking about signs, the sign of the Savior's coming. And so I think that's always a fun thing to pay attention to.
Absolutely. To continue on with the thought about hearts really quickly, though, the very after you get that high concentration of heart, and actually Samuel says it twice as he's beginning his speech, the Lord hath, you know, these are the things the Lord hath put into my heart, and the Lord has put into my heart to say, and then he goes on. Verse 8, though, thus saith the Lord, because of the hardness of the hearts of the people of Nephi. And then he again, you know, except they repent, I will turn the hearts of their brethren against them. And there's actually several more times throughout the chapter that you have a repetition of the hardened hearts of the Nephites are brought up. Their hearts are set upon riches in verse 20, and also in 21. And also 21, to your point about Samuel's name, and have not hearkened unto the words of him who gave them unto you. Your hearts are not drawn out unto the Lord. It almost seems like the intent here is to set up a contrast. Again, in 27, they walk in the pride of their own hearts, and whatsoever your heart desireth. There's this contrast where the Lord is able to pierce into the heart of Samuel and put words into his heart.
Mm-hmm.
Something he could not do to the Nephites himself because of the hardness of their hearts.
And something the Nephites couldn't do to him because they couldn't pierce them with their arrows.
Oh, burn.
Very nice.
Neil, going back to your point with about the gestures, I think that was you. Is that you?
That was Jasmine, actually.
Oh, Jasmine. Okay, Jasmine's point about the gestures. First of all, he stretches forth his hand, and then he says, the sword of justice hangeth over this people, which that gesture of raising the hand, based on some explanations by John Gee, is of the phrase, his hand is stretched forth still.
Yeah.
That gesture is known as the smite gesture.
That's so like when he does this in the Lord's hand.
Exactly. He's personifying the Lord by extending his hand in a gesture of, that means fundamentally, I'm about to smite you with this sword. In order to personify the sword of justice hanging over the people. And then it's interesting because he says, and 400 years pass not away, save the sword of justice falleth upon this people, which is the prophecy that, was it Alma gave to Helaman, or was it Helaman gave to his son?
Alma gave to Helaman, yes.
Alma gave to Helaman, yes.
In Alma
but
25.
He gave it to him in secret. But now Samuel, because of the hard-heartedness of the people of Nephi, has been directed to give it openly.
And I actually wanted to comment on that, because can you imagine President Nelson getting up in conference and saying, guys, we're in big trouble. We urgently need to repent because in 400 years, the Lord's going to destroy us. Would you really feel that sense of urgency there? It's kind of funny, and it's a little jarring. But I do think it's quite significant, actually, because a number of scholars, John Sorensen was the first that I'm aware of who pointed this out, but John Clark has talked about it, as has Mark Wright, all of them PhDs in Mesoamerican archaeology or anthropology, and excellent scholars. They've pointed out that 400 years in for the Mayan, that's a baktun. And that's a time cycle that's significant among the Maya, and in fact, it's I called it a time cycle because that's how they saw time. It was cyclical. It was something that went around and around and repeated itself, and they expected what happens now to happen again in 400 years. The completion of every baktun was, you would repeat the events of the previous baktun. And so for Samuel to say, the sword of justice hangeth over this people, the implication being now, and then to also say, 400 years, a baktun later, the sword of justice is going to fall on the people, the implication of what he's saying, given their cyclical view of time, is that the sword of justice is going to fall on you now if you don't repent.
Oh.
So I think that's a very interesting and subtle detail.
Well, there's the baktun, which is the 400 years, right? And then the loltun and the holtun, I think. Is it holtun?
Baktun? Well, if we want to go through all of them.
I mean, there's three that were pointed out that were very specific measurements.
There's the baktun, which is the 400 years. Right. There's the katun, which is...
Katun.
20 years. The lotun is actually a thing. It's 10 years.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And then the hotun is 5 years.
Got it. Okay. Now, something interesting about that phrase, the sword of justice hangeth over. Brant Gardner has pointed out that that's actually probably a more modern phrase, a little more modern of allusion or more modern of imagery, because there wasn't any kind of comparable weapon within Mesoamerican culture that would probably be like a sword. The most comparable thing you would have be like a club or like a studded club, something like that. And so to use this phrase to him suggested that this was probably Joseph's own kind of interpolation on the text. But I don't know if you guys have any other opinions regarding that.
Well, I am familiar with Brant's opinion on that matter. And Brant is an intelligent fellow. He knows much more about both the Book of Mormon and Mesoamerica than I do. So. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend picking my opinion over his 9 times out of 10.
He says that he was referring to the
Damocles
is the pronunciation, and I think it's wrong.
Thank you. Leave it
to Hales.
Hales.
Dr. Swift in the house here.
Here's the thing: the sword of Damocles, it's hanging. It's an image of it. The sword is hanging by a thread, and the thread could break at any moment and kill a person, right? Is that how you guys understand the sword of Damocles?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Which makes it basically a great metaphor for things like chance and probabilistic risk and, great concepts like this. And a terrible personification for justice. This has nothing to do with the sword of justice. They're not the same sword, dang it. The sword of justice has a precision and even a timeliness to it. Maybe not the timeliness you want, but if you will, an assuredness of it happening that the sword of Damocles will never provide. It does not have this sword does not have the same symbolic valence as the sword of Damocles, any way you look at it.
Yeah, and I actually think what you mentioned earlier, Hales, gives us a very different visual for this thing. If his ritual gesture, his ritual action of raising his hand up, as he mentions the sword of justice hanging over them, if we envision, instead of a sword dangling kind of above them in the ethereal, in the sky, if you will, which, if that is the kind of image you want, they did have sharp-pointed spears, right? And McQuawitz didn't always have a sharp point at the end, but they did sometimes. Yeah. But I think Hales conjures up a very different image here of instead the Lord with his arm stretched forth with the sword of justice,
in his hand
ready to strike.
Yeah.
And that the Mesoamerican sword, the McQuawitz, is entirely appropriate for that kind of image.
Right, and the way it's described, it's not necessarily describing a falling and a piercing. It's a falling and a slashing, if we are talking about the sword in the hand of God, that the sword of justice falleth upon the people. And there's also biblical precedents for a sword wielding justice. You've got the cherubim guarding the tree of life in Genesis. You've got the angel appearing to Joshua with a sword in the book of Joshua. And then you've also got Solomon wielding justice by threatening to cleave the baby in half in that story. I mean, there's precedent in biblical Israel for using swords to execute God's will. And so I don't think we have to limit ourselves to Mesoamerica in this case.
I mean, Samuel's probably the most spectacular use of that imagery, isn't he?
And what's our Lamanite's name? Just,
just saying.
Well, but the Old Testament prophet Samuel, after Saul captures this guy instead of executing him as he was supposed to, Samuel says to him, oh, shoot. Can somebody get the actual quote?
I know what you're talking about, but...
He basically says, he utters a simile curse. It's to the effect of, as your sword has left mother's childless, so your mother shall be childless among women. And then it says, and he hacked him to death. Act him in pieces before the Lord.
Lovely.
Which is a very clear, is a formulaic invocation of wielding the sword of justice. I mean, that's exactly what's happening there. And that appears to be exactly what's happening in this Samuel imagery as well.
Now that you bring up the biblical prophet Samuel, I did want to say this before I forgot. Another connection with the name Samuel is that the biblical prophet Samuel in the Old Testament was the one who anointed David to be king over all of Israel. He anointed him as the Messiah, if you will, as an anointed one of Christ. And it's Samuel the Lamanite here who is the one who is anointing or bringing the sign of Jesus Christ to come. And so I think there's an interesting parallel there as well, as the one inducing and introducing the king of Israel.
So, and again, I do want to reiterate, I think Brandt's great, and he's got a lot of really good insights. I do occasionally disagree with him, though, and I'm pretty sure he's okay with that, because I don't, like I said, 9 times out of 10, you're probably safer going with his opinion over mine anyway.
He's a good scholar.
Yeah, excellent. But in this case, I think there's plenty of other ways to see this notion of the sword hanging over the people that needn't be invoking that seemingly anachronistic image. Is there any... I'm assuming we fairly well have exhausted our thoughts on swords here.
Yes, indeed.
Though, I will just make one more mention with cyclical time in mind.
We've beaten that sword to death.
And the time, cycles that... that I mentioned before, as I noted, in addition to the Bach tune, the 400-year cycle, there's an important cycle called the Ka tune, and time's repeating itself along Ka tunes as well as Bach tunes, and it's noteworthy that exactly 20 years later, in 3 Nephi 2:19, Mormon reports that the sword of destruction did hang over the Nephites. So we see, basically, here at the time of Samuel, the sword's hanging over. 20 years later, the sword's hanging over, and 400 years later, the sword will fall. So that's kind of a nice little set of time cycles that fit very well with the Maya conceptions of time.
As an sort of untangential comment. It's when I was first introduced to the concept of these cyclical time cycles in Mesoamerican culture, I thought it was a little bit odd and maybe a bit naive. Like, well, how can you think that time repeats itself? It's linear, because I grew up in Western civilization. But, you know, recently, in these last few months, it certainly has helped me appreciate that worldview of cyclical time, as we've had a massive pandemic like the 1918 flu, stock market crash like in the earlier 20th century, threatened World War III just like in the earlier 20th century. I mean, we're seeing a lot of parallels and repeats from the turn of the century now that we're in a new century. So while I think it's mostly just coincidental, I did think it was funny. I'm like, huh, well, I guess I could see how they might view time as cyclical as opposed to linear.
Since we're talking of cyclicality, you'll recall that Nephi calls for famine just a few chapters earlier. And Samuel comments on famine also. He says, speaking in the voice of the Lord, "Yea, I will visit them with the sword and with famine and with pestilence." And so they had famine at that point too, and they were actually able to find that famine in the stele records, so in the,
the
geological...
The stalactites and stalagmites.
Sorry, not stele. Sorry, that's the wrong word. Good job. You got it, Neil. So they were able to find evidence for that particular famine in the stalactites. And if I recall, there was also... They found a later set of famines, much later, that were proximate to when the Nephites finally met their end. So, although that doesn't get commented on much that I recall, I think you can actually make the case that we have evidence for the fulfillment of that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway.
We maybe should try to cover at least some material from the other chapters in the section, but does anybody else have anything on Helaman 13?
Well, there is this one. Well, one thing that we perhaps could bring up is near the end of Helaman 13, the use of treasures becoming slippery. I want to talk about the criticism associated with that, really, just really briefly.
Why don't you go ahead?
Sure. Let me kind of pull up a summary here. And it's in Helaman 13. This is verse 31. Helaman said, Samuel says, "And behold, the time cometh that he curseth your riches, that they become slippery, that ye cannot hold them. In the days of your poverty, ye cannot retain them." And so Samuel's making a kind of a social critique on Nephi people and saying that they're too caught up within their riches, and that there will be a curse coming in which they cannot even hold on to their treasures at some point, right? That it will become slippery. Some people have criticized the Book of Mormon on these grounds, and particularly Joseph Smith on these grounds. They're saying that he's probably importing something from his own culture. In Joseph Smith's day, they sought for he was associated with treasure seeking, and one of the and there was belief in treasures that would slip further and further into the ground as one tried to uncover them and did not go through a guardian angel in order to uncover the treasures. And so some have criticized the Book of Mormon on these grounds and saying that Joseph Smith may have kind of imported this imagery. But we find that this is actually an imagery that's also common in the ancient world. For instance, Kevin Barney has noted that that this is basically the same imagery that's invoked in Proverbs and associated. And Proverbs apparently is influenced by the book of I forget the name of it right off the top of my head. I think it's here it is. The Instruction of MNMOP. In which basically the same the imagery is implied, except it says that the treasures will not become slippery; they'll fly into the sky, they'll escape us basically. And so the criticism kind of remains on shaky grounds as far as that goes.
Sure. And for what it's worth, for those who may be interested in looking at this, there is a NoWhy on Book of Mormon Central that talks about this issue. Why did Samuel say the wealth of the Nephites would become slippery? It's NoWhy number 539 at the Book of Mormon Central, and it is tagged to Helaman 13:31. So that's you can look it up that way to learn more. But why don't we go ahead and jump into Helaman 14? And I know you guys are getting sick of this, but I'm gonna harp on some calendrics just one more time. Very, you know, right out of the chute in Helaman 14 here, Samuel prophesies, he says, I give unto you a sign for 5 years more cometh. Behold, then cometh the Son of God to redeem all those who shall believe on his name. And he gives several signs for that event. But as we noted when we were talking about the Bach tune, there are other time cycles, and one of them is the Ho tune, which is the five-year prophecy, or the five-year cycle. And this was a significant time cycle for the Maya, too. They would erect a stela, a king would erect a stela for every Ho tune that passed over the course of his reign. And they would have a big celebration, and it would be this, you know, they'd make a big deal out of it. And that was a significant time as well. So both of the numbers that Samuel's throwing around here are significant in Maya calendrics. But it's also interesting because we know at least by the time of the European conquest, Maya shamans and prophets and holy men were expected to give prophecies of what would unfold over the course of the next Katun, or the next 20-year period, 5 years in advance. And so what we have happening here, it would seem, is Samuel is basically giving a prophecy of what's going to happen over the course of the next Bachtun, or 400-year cycle, and he's doing it 5 years in advance. So there's so just a couple of interesting things there about that number, that five-year number that shows up here.
And it makes sense, right, because I think Brandt and others have said that the Lamanites are likely components of or related to the Maya culture.
Yeah, and I think most people would assume that Lamanites are more given to the practices of surrounding cultures than the Nephites are, who tried to hold fairly fastidiously to their Israelite roots in various ways. And I'm sure they had to make adaptations, and there still was some cultural influence. But, yeah, Samuel's a Lamanite, and they often, you know, Brandt has made a very compelling case that they were very strongly influenced by Mesoamerican culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we've talked about how the Hotun might influence the believers versus non-believers' interpretation of the prophecy of Christ's birth.
Well, yeah, that starts to get into 3 Nephi 1, which is technically outside
our
scripture block. But there is that interesting situation there where they seem to think the time has passed, and yet you've got believers who are still kind of holding out, and then they set a specific date, like, well, if it doesn't happen by this day, it really is too late, we're going to kill you. Which, you know, that escalated quickly. But, you know, to me, the only way that story makes sense is if there's a time at which you could reasonably say it had passed, but also be able to reasonably say, but it could still happen until this day, right?
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, this whole thing doesn't make sense. Well, one way to look at that, and I wrote a paper on this. It was published in the Interpreter Foundation journal, so you can look it up there. There's actually two different ways to count the year in among the Maya. There's what we usually call the tune, and you should know this is more scholarly convention. The Maya mixed up the terminology all the time. They actually used the same terms for both. But what we usually call the tune is actually technically a 360-day cycle rather than a 365-day cycle. And then what we usually call the Hab, is the kind of the 365-day approximate solar year. They don't have leap years to correct it as it gets a little off. But they have, basically they have 360-day years and 365-day years. And so, and since they use the same terminology for both, they don't actually use two different words. It's not hard to see how the people could have, you know, once 5 360-day years are up, you've got the unbelievers saying, okay, the time is up. You know, it's past. The prophecy wasn't fulfilled.
you should stop believing. But you've got the believers basically holding out for that extra 25 days that's created by counting by 365-day years instead.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see the unbelievers saying, okay, we'll grant that that could potentially be a valid interpretation, so we'll mark our calendars the day that comes. If the sign hasn't come by then, it'll never come, and we're going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a part of that is not only does there have to be two different times in which it could have passed, but there's got to be a way to make sense of why the date that was set as the day it had to happen actually was the day it happened. And to me, it makes sense if it uh-huh. really was a five-year anniversary, just not the five-year anniversary they were expecting. But anyway, like I said, that's technically getting us into 3 Nephi 1. Does anybody else have any thoughts on Helaman 14?
I can think of. We've got in this one, he prophesies of the destruction, specifically of Christ's death, how there will be thunderings and lightning, and how valleys will become mountains. Mountains will be brought low. And this is what the angel has spoken up to. So, prophecies of his birth and prophecies of his death.
Well, and you know, I have always, and this isn't a particularly unique insight, but I have always liked the fact that the prophecies about his birth all revolve around light. There's new lights in the heaven, a new star. There's other signs in the heavens that they see, which I presume are things like shooting stars and asteroids and things like that. And there's a day and a night and a day that's all light. So the light of the world, right, coming into the world and being introduced by light. And then what is the sign of his leaving this world? It's darkness, all darkness. The light of the world is left. It is dark. Again, I know lots of people have said that, but I do like the poetics there.
Which is something that you, specifically Neil, have pointed out, is that they give a specific time frame for the birth, but they don't necessarily give the exact date of the death, which goes back to the idea of Mayan calendrics, of there being significance in 5 years, 20 years, 400 years. 33 years, not so much.
We do have some indication. 3 Nephi 8 does suggest that they had some prophecy somewhere that told them how long it was. Maybe that came from Samuel, but we don't have that recorded here. Why not? Well, yeah, 33 years or 34 years, they didn't really care about that number very much. are there any other thoughts? Maybe do we want to jump to Helaman 15?
Real quick, I've got a poem about Samuel's prophecy, if you want.
Go right ahead.
All right. 2 days go by, a night between to separate their light. Between the walks of clearness walks where faith replaces sight. So is the world we now enjoy, though filled with shadows deep. Couched tween two great eternities, between the twain we sleep. Assured still that we shall wake to light when eyes shall close. And so the man shall sleep in peace, approaching death who knows. There was once 2 days that not a dark night could divide. They were thus joined as one, united as a circle's side. For in that day a new light came to lighten all the earth, purging the darkness tween the days upon his night of birth. So, too, he is a light in death, a light beyond the grave. He gave to us his light in death, that from death he might save, and cover all our frailties in coverings of power, and drive the darkness from our lives by lighting hour by hour. So as the days grow short and shadows hide the heaven's rays, remember ye that heaven's light has shined between the days. So there you go.
Beautiful.
Wonderful. So Helaman 15 then?
In chapter 15, Samuel and Lamanites continues his prophecies. In this case, he's more preaching to the Nephites about how the Lord is chasing them because he loves them. And that the Lamanites, in contrast, have been more firm in the faith than the Nephites. There's one point that I was looking into this week as I was studying, and that's when he references the bearing of the weapons. in chapter 15, verse 9, it is talking about how many of the Lamanites who have come to know the truth have become firm and steadfast, more so than the Nephites. And it says that, and you know also that they have buried their weapons of war, and they fear to take them up, lest by any means they should sin. And for behold, they will suffer to be trodden down and slain, and will not lift up their swords against them, and this because of their faith in Christ. And this just made me think of if this possibly is referring to the people of Ammon, and the footnote talk is a direct reference to the people of Ammon, and if Samuel the Lamanite is possibly one of them, if that is perhaps an explanation for his righteousness and his reference and allusion to that story, is if that is his people. He is of the Lamanites, but he is of the people of Ammon, and how the Lamanites have become, they've been converted, they're steadfast in the faith. In fact, we've even buried our weapons. And as I was talking about this with Neil, he pointed out how it might be particularly necessary, or it might be particularly on Samuel's mind to get the Nephites to repent, because the Ammonites are being protected by the Nephites. They are the only thing standing in the way between them and destruction. I don't know if, Neil, you want to jump in.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's worth pointing out that in addition to the Ammonites, there was, earlier in the book of Helaman, there was another instance recorded where Lamanites converted the gospel and took an oath and forsook their weapons of war. And my presumption is that they then went and they would have settled in Jershon with the... actually, they moved them from Jershon during the war. Now, I'm not remembering where they moved them, though. But in any case, they would have settled with the descendants at this point. It were a couple generations down the road, but the descendants of the Ammonites. And the point being, you've got these multiple waves of conversions of Lamanites who then vow not to take up weapons. And they're dependent, I presume this new generation of Lamanites who have done that are every bit as dependent on the Nephites for their defense and their protection as the Ammonites were. And so if the Nephites are becoming wicked, that means two things. One, if they are still willing to protect these vulnerable Lamanites, they aren't going to be very effective. Because we know one of the consistent messages in the Book of Mormon is that when you're not righteous, when the Lamanite, or when the Nephites in particular, aren't righteous, they don't have the strength of the Lord to fight with them, and their own strength is pretty much never strong enough to hold their enemies at bay. So that's their first thing, is they're not, even if they do try to protect you guys, they're not going to be a very potent defense, because they don't have the Lord fighting on their side. But the second problem is, they're wicked. So who's to say they're even going to protect you at this point, rather than actually even maybe potentially becoming a threat to you, because they recognize you're quite vulnerable. And so this risk to Samuel's own community, potentially his own community, may very well be the impetus for why he was called by the Lord in the first place, and why it had to be him, why it had to be a Lamanite, right? Because it's the Lamanite interests that are at risk here. Those are just some thoughts that we had.
I'm particularly interested by a thing that's been pointed out by several scholars now of the Book of Mormon, and that's in verse 4 of Helaman 15, where, referring to the Lamanites, it says, "But behold, my brethren, the Lamanites hath he hated, because their deeds have been evil continually, and this because of the iniquity of the tradition of their fathers." He's referring to the Lord and saying that the Lord hated the Lamanites. It's been pointed out by David Bakavoy that, you know, there is words like love and hate often refer not to necessarily an emotional status in the ancient world, but rather to a covenant status of a person to their higher vassal or suzerain. Bakavoy, he was a graduate student at the time he wrote this. In biblical studies at the time he wrote this, he explained, "Scholars in recent decades have shown that in the biblical world, the word love often represented a covenantal devotion to one's superior, while its opposite, namely hate, at times signified the status of an individual outside of this affiliation. While the connotation of these words for Westerners usually signifies an intense emotional charge, in the ancient Near East, love and hate often carried the aforementioned unique covenantal connotation." And so this verse has caused some concern for people, just simply because they're saying, why would the Lord hate anybody? The Lord doesn't hate anybody. His love is infinite for us, and we've
You've heard that message a number of times from both the scriptures and from modern day prophets. You know, and I think that this kind of adds some unique and clarifying context to that. What I wanted to make kind of on the larger point is that this kind of plays into to theologians who are what I'm a philosophy major at Brigham Young University, and so I'm always sensitive to this kind of thing, to this type of reading of the Book of Mormon. But there's a philosopher by the name of John Austin who talks about how language can be performative, how when we use language to create new relationships, right? So when I say, till death do you part, I now pronounce you husband and wife until death do you part, you've now created a new relationship, and so you can now create these new identities and relationships with language. I think that a similar thing is being employed in the ancient world. These words like love and hate, they're being used because they do affect your heart. They do affect your heart, and they cause you to change. They cause you to do something. I think that you can apply that to a lot of different areas of the gospel where you might have questions as to why things were said this way or that way. You can kind of take it in the sense that these things, as they're said, they create a new person within you. They create a new motivation within you. When you hear that you are hated by God, it motivates you to be introspective. It just does. To understand what your relationship is to Him and to take the necessary actions to repair that relationship with Him so that you can receive the blessings that He promises to you.
Yeah, excellent. Great thought.
And like you said, the bottom line is that the Lord did not hate the Lamanites in an emotional way, but rather they were outside the covenant. The Nephites were the covenant. They were the chosen. You were the chosen one, Anakin. It might be better to say the Lamanites hath he hated. Instead, you might think the Lamanites were outside of the covenant because they were their deeds were evil continually. And
yeah,
because of the traditions of their fathers giving them false ideas. However, salvation hath come to them through the preaching of the Nephites. And because of this, the Lord has prolonged their days. He's being merciful to them. And so just showing that the Lord does love them. He's extended their days. He's brought salvation to them because they have repented. They've converted. And that's what it's about. It's about the covenant between the Lord and His people.
And the implication there that He has brought salvation to them is that they are now within the covenant, right? They are no longer outside the covenant, which is maybe perhaps makes it significant that hated occurs in past tense here. They were outside the covenant, but now they are not. Does anybody else have any other thoughts on 15, or should we jump to chapter 16? Let's go ahead then. On to chapter 16.
I had one quick thought on 15. In verse 2, it says, about halfway through, "Yea, and woe unto them which are with child, for they shall be heavy and cannot flee, therefore they shall be trodden down, and shall be left to perish." At the first part they also says, "Yea, except you repent, your women shall have great cause to mourn in the day that they shall give suck, for ye shall attempt to flee, and there shall be no place for refuge." Later on, Mormon writes to his son Moroni and mentions specifically that the suffering of their women and children is terrible. So this actually gets the fulfillment is documented in Mormon's letter to his son Moroni.
That's interesting. Very subtle detail there. Would have been easy to it would have been easy for a Joseph Smith to forget to fulfill that promise there. All right, chapter 16 then, the final chapter we're going to cover today. We only have a few more minutes, but plenty of time to discuss a few topics here. Does anybody have anything they'd like to cover with 16?
Verse 16. Okay. "Some things they may have guessed right among so many, but behold, we know that all these great and marvelous works cannot come to pass of which has been spoken."
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Joseph Smith, the world's greatest guest.
I think that's been the defense since about 1820, hasn't it?
Yeah, indeed.
Or wait, it was 1830. It's 1830, sorry.
It's so easy to attribute miracles of God to natural or naturalistic means. And those who want to see the glass half empty are always going to see it. But chapter 16 is all about the conclusion of Samuel's words, and it says after he spoke upon the wall that the people that believed went to Nephi and confessed their sin and desired that they would be baptized with him, just showing the great change of heart. But those who weren't going to believe cast stones and shot arrows, but the Spirit of the Lord was with him, so they could not hit him. And once again, a kind of a almost a connection to Nephi and Abinadi, how the power of the Lord was upon them and they could be harmed when they stretched forth their hand in the power of the Lord. They couldn't be physically harmed. And when they couldn't hit him, more did believe. And so then they also went to Nephi to be baptized. There seems to be two migrations of people going to Nephi to be baptized. And almost a return to, like you mentioned, the people that were called Nephi. It's almost distancing them that these people are false Nephites. But those who believe are now returning to the prophet named Nephi, as in like a return to the true meaning of Nephites being the covenant people of the Lord.
Well, along those lines, I mean, we've talked about Matt Bowen and his onomastic or his names studies. One of the things he's talked about is the name Nephi meaning good or fair. The word plays off of that with good. And also in Mormon 7, when he says, oh, ye fair ones, right? Ye Nephites, if you will. could it be that Samuel is rhetorically, you know, the ones who are called the good ones, the ones who are called the fair ones, but not really, not really the good ones. Just a thought.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely valid. And it's kind of amusing that there's two ways, right? Those who repented when they heard him, and those who repented when they realized that they were normally better shots than this.
And it talks about how in the 90th year there began to be great signs and wonders of the people. And that's where we get that verse about some people supposing that Samuel just guessed right and that these aren't really marvelous works. But they truly are. Those who have eyes to see and ears to hear, let them hear. And we see that today in the world. It's really easy to not see the miracles of God every single day in our lives. And to not see the prophetic nature of what President Nelson has been telling us over the last year, last few months. I've been humbled to see how prescient it's been and relevant to my life and to the world today with coronavirus and all the things the world's experiencing. The prophets, they truly are on a watchtower, and they watch out for it. And, that pretty much wraps up Helaman 16. Say that Samuel was never heard of again, and
until the Lord came.
Until the Lord came, and then that, and yeah, it is interesting that the Lord also made it a point to include Samuel's prophecy. Originally, this wasn't going to be part of our record, but then when the Lord comes, he says, "What about the prophecies of Samuel?" And he has them added back into their record. And so it's thanks to very literal divine intervention that we even have this record. And so I think that is a message to us of how important it is to study and to learn from. There's got to be a lot here for us if the Lord wanted that so bad.
Returning to an earlier theme, I think it also illustrates that we need to be prepared to learn from those who are not part of our immediate culture. And basically be willing to hear the word of the Lord wherever it may appear. In the previous chapter, there's also another point I forgot to make, which is that even though Samuel was sent by the Lord, those who repented of his teaching went to Nephi, because Nephi was the regularly ordained and established leader of the church in that area. So the Lord and Samuel also arguably showed respect for the normal order of the church and set the example of sending the person who was regularly ordained rather than subverting the order of the church by having someone external and not previously acknowledged by the church come and preach and take over things rather than using the existing structure.
Right, and what is interesting about that is it's the authority issues, right? The performance of ordinances that they go to the actual head of the church for. But nonetheless, Samuel is someone, here's the Lord working with someone outside of your typical expected channels. And so it maybe is a reminder, and we don't know what position maybe Samuel held with among the convert the church as it stood among converted Lamanites or whatever. But as far as the city and the people of Zarahemla were concerned, the prophet and the head of the church was Nephi. But God was willing to work outside those channels, and it is maybe a good reminder, as you said, that we should be willing to listen and hear the voice of the Lord in unexpected places and from people who are different from us and even maybe outside our faith at times. But I think that that pretty much wraps us up. We're hitting 9 o'clock on the money here. But this has been The Interpreter Show. Once again, I am Neil Rapley, joined here in studio by Jasmine, my wife, Spencer Marsh, and the phone, joining us by phone has been the very insightful Steve. I don't know, I almost called you Steven. The very insightful
Hales. Definitely that's true too, but keep going.
The very insightful Hales Swift. And thank you for tuning in, and we will see you next month.
Good to be with you.
Mm-hmm.